this week's episode of Still Entitled is made possible by Thinkful. Do you hate your job? Well, you can always quit and become a developer or data scientist with Thinkful instead. Thinkful is an online education platform that offers fast-paced learning to take you from a beginner to job-ready in 6 months or your tuition back. Start off the new year by pursuing your dream career in technology. Go to thinkful.com/untitled for a $600 scholarship. Again, that's thinkful.com/untitled. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Well, hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
If the shop looks cleaner,
it does,
to you today than it normally does, it's because Sketchfest is in town.
I wondered if Marie Kondo had been here, actually.
Marie Kondo's always here in spirit. Sketchfest is in town, and we're throwing a party in the next couple of days.
Nice.
So I'm making it party ready.
I went down and looked at the list of stuff a couple weeks ago, and they announced the acts.
It's always an unbelievable roster.
Wow, all these
Sketch
good people.
Fest, we talked about before for people you know. It's an annual festival co-run by Janet Varney. It's a comedy shows, special events.
It's kind of a variety show at this point, though. It's like live performances of all sorts,
but of every possible sort.
Yeah.
So you know, from Jonathan Colton to Jonathan Winters. I mean, when he was around. You know, I interviewed Spinal Tap on stage as part of Sketchfest. Paul F. Tompkins and Akron Blacker and the Thrilling Adventure Hour people have done it many years.
Portlandia,
West Wing Weekly people come
right.
every year.
And so, like, it is always an amazing festival. I cannot believe that Janet Varney and her team, her wonderful team of partners, put it on every year. They always seem relatively calm. Given that they're flying hundreds of recalcitrant comedians from all over the world to San Francisco.
Oh, they love gathering. There's one event happening this year. I'm so bummed I won't be able to make it. I think Kishore is actually going. San Francisco has an immersive theater experience, a speakeasy, which I think we've talked about.
Yeah.
You spend like 4 hours in 1920s speakeasy somewhere in North Beach of San Francisco. It's all era appropriate, and they're doing events for Sketchfest with comedians on the stage. I think John Hodgman's doing it.
Are they doing 1920s era sets?
I don't know.
Hodgman's
going to start reading some Peter Benchley,
wow.
right?
He will be a part of the cast.
I mean the Vicious Circle Peter Benchley, not the Jaws author.
Fair. He's perfect for that. He's the man. He's the man for that time.
John is totally awesome for that. Before we started recording,
yes.
I was showing you guys my new drawing table, and it's a mechanical arm for maintaining straightness and horizontality and verticality.
Like your perspective line. I mean, so I've always seen that used for mechanical drafting and like CAD, like pre-CAD, CAD work.
Yeah, a type of drawing I really excelled at in high school. I love to do still freehand. And I've had one of these arms for a long time. We should post a picture of it.
Yeah.
We were talking about the early days of graphic design because I learned graphic design in New York in the mid 80s. Mm-hmm. My first job was operating a stat camera. So when you wanted things blown up or reduced, Xerox machines didn't even do it back then.
No, you used film.
So you had to go to a photostat camera, get photo paper in a dark room, load it in, put your object down, figure out exactly what size it needed to be, spec by the designer. Then you turned on the lights, turned them back off again, and developed the photo paper and handed it to the designer. It was
and
a laborious process.
Or for
any magnification or shrinkage.
Not crops. Crops you could just do with a razor.
Right.
So the thing, Norm, you grew up in a digital, entirely digital. So I started magazines. Yeah, I started magazines in 2000, and it was right as we were shifting from a digital prepress to and a still analog post, where we would shoot photos of the pages and then make separations that would go to the press.
Photos of pages.
So we would you know, at first they would do things like tape, cut and tape the columns with scotch tape and glue them on a pasteboard and then put them up in front of the camera and shoot that and send the film via FedEx to the press. And
So when you wanted type of a specific font and a specific size, you ordered it from a Sotronics printer, and there was some guy with a cigarette sitting at this gigantic, it was like a giant pipe organ sized thing, and he would type in and then he would pump out left justified, right justified, center justified.
It's a typewriter for type.
Right. And it would print it out in high resolution on film. And then you would glue that to a piece of cardboard with blue lines and crop marks drawn in.
And then then you would take the blue lines out in the separation, right?
Well, the blue lines disappear when you photograph it.
Oh, right.
If you wanted big areas of black, you'd use Ruby Lith because red shows up as black. My first job was as a photostat operator. My second job was as a type specker. So one of the
what's a type specker do? I don't know that one.
So I worked for this amazing woman, Laura Teresi, in New York City. She might actually still be there. Laura Teresi Design. It was this group of four female designers. I was the only man that lasted longer than 2 weeks, and I lasted a year and a half.
Wow.
They were awesome. Not to say that like they it was a fantastic
like a Witches of Eastwick situation in there.
It was not. They were so lovely. I learned so much in that shop. But their big business was annual reports, and that was the sweet jobs to get in graphic design back then was annual reports because big public companies had to put them out. They were packed with information that had to be precisely laid out. And often the companies would allocate a real budget for these. And so designers, like all the top designers got all the top companies and would cut loose on the design. Like there was a famous Minneapolis design firm called the Duffy Group that kind of established that you might be too young to remember, but in the mid 80s, there was this big return to a kind of a mid-century boys' life sort of aesthetic.
Oh, yeah.
Duffy Group was at the very front of that, and they were putting out the best annual reports.
Like Rockwell-esque paintings.
Yeah.
But
so when you got an annual report in its raw form from your client, it was just hundreds of pages of stuff you had to lay out. My job as a type specker was to count up the literal, do the math and figure out the literal exact amount of column inches at the correct font, at the correct justification, and then figure out how many pages it would take to lay that out through all the photographs that had been laid out.
Literally a job that you drag the corner of a box and drag on a computer today.
Right.
Or you just press down on the font size and fits.
So I had to, what you did was you counted up the specific number of characters and spaces in 10 lines, and then you extrapolated that out.
Oh, right, because they're not monospace fonts, so you have to...
You have to average it out.
You have to reverse lorem ipsum.
10 lines good enough for...
10 lines was good. It was good enough to get you really... to get you into the zone.
With the margin. Where did the designers like designing them? Like, what was the most visually interesting part? Was it the cover page? Was it graphs?
There was always some really cool stuff going on. Like the Duffy Group released an annual report, I think somewhere around 1987, where the cover was like a faux leather with like a tie and a feather in it.
Wow.
I mean, I actually managed to get one of these by calling the company and pretending to be an investor. And that was what you did as a designer. Like you could only collect the stuff that way.
Who has that collection?
Just buy that
today.
One stock. One share
right,
of stock.
Yeah, one share. And then there was, even in the layouts, things got really bold and quite exciting.
This reminds me of like there's for investor meetings, like big conventions or corporations, they like sometimes put on musicals or presentations that no one will ever see except the 1,000 people who are there for the shareholders
meeting. That's what my wife used to do for a living.
And these are like the pieces of art, technically, that have a commercial purpose and a business purpose.
Well, it's definitely design, right? Like it's what's like the genre. It's like executive walk-on music. You know about this, right?
Yeah.
Like pop songs that are designed specifically so that executives have something hyped up to walk on to when they're at a big conference. So U2's Vertigo, pretty much everything by the Black Eyed Peas, you know, like it's hype up music for a crowd.
Jamie and I did a whole stage tour where it was Back in Black.
Yeah, that's a perfect one. I mean, that's only for cool executives, Adam.
That's a classic music piece for, I guess it was an Iron Man, for coming, like, for in the second act, but right before third act, when the hero rebuilds themselves after the downfall.
Yeah, after the downfall.
Did you ever hear about Mickey Rourke on Iron Man 2 that for the scene in which he shows up at the racetrack in Iron Man 2, I know it's hard to remember such a terrible movie.
Yeah, you know, he has the whips and he has the whips, right? The
and so apparently Mickey Rourke wanted, and full marks, like if this is what you need as an actor, this is what you should have. He asked for music to be played really loud on set that would get him into the mood of the character.
This is a racetrack.
And
it's
they
loud.
Removed it. They removed it in post, obviously. But apparently everyone on the crew was so sick of this music by the end of the day. I can't even remember what it was, you know. Chameleon Air or something like that. Maybe not.
A Jamiroquai. It's funny that... So that happened... The analog to digital transition happened with print. Mm-hmm. And then everything's been kind of like... In 2004, 2005, we switched from the film prepress to PDF.
Yeah.
And switched from Quark Express to InDesign. And then nothing's changed.
You know, I've never been able to figure out InDesign even a little bit.
You're a Quark person.
I am. Not only am I a Quark person, but I'm like... I need to find a Quark jockey because I have all I Quark, and what you're describing is Quark Express works the way pre-digital designers think.
Works, yeah.
And that's the only way I can think. InDesign is literally a mystifying ordeal to me. I have documents on Quark that are so old, Quark won't open them unless I buy legacy versions of
Quark.
That
was the business model. You to update every year, buy the software.
Oh my God, it's killing me. I have all this old stuff that I can't even look at.
Well, I don't know that company. Are they still around?
Corel bought them, I think, years ago. It's a sad story for a different kind of podcast, but that transition was really, really difficult, and it was marked by OS X, the transition to OS X, because Quark was slow to support OS X, and Adobe was right on it. And as a result, they own the world now.
Well, I mean, I never thought that Quark was perfect software, but it did operate precisely how I thought. Everything I needed was where I thought it ought to be.
So the thing about that is you probably weren't working in that world anymore when that transition happened. So never had to embed.
No, it was always casual for me after that.
Yeah, it's like I spent over the holidays. I did a project that required that I learn how to use Illustrator for the first time, which has always felt like bad Photoshop to me. bad Photoshop for vectors, right there.
I'm right there. Yeah. With less menus.
Yeah. So I got a friend who is very good at Illustrator and lasering stuff to walk me through it. And she spent 30 minutes on the phone with me one afternoon and made a world of difference in my ability to use that. Just like she gave me enough of the basic stuff that I could then move forward. And like a lot of that is for people who like to learn stuff on their own instead of going and sitting down, taking a boring class or something, which I think we're probably all in that category.
Yeah.
That is much more helpful to me, even though it's pretty selfish to take somebody's 30 minutes, whatever, than trying to blow through the other way.
I mean, that's been a big complaint for software, right? Like we started with before we got to phones and tablets, very complex pieces of software that required training and expertise to master, whether you're talking about with vectors or even Photoshop, right? And since the phone came out, apps have simplified things, but I found that in the simplification, because they're done so you can reach a bigger market, right? More people can get access to these apps. There's a lot of hidden complexity, and I think we're hitting this nice middle ground.
I think we're right at the bad part of that right now. Like if you look at those conversations about, oh hey, did you know you can clear all of your tabs in Safari on iOS by long pressing the done button at the bottom of the screen?
Or how do you erase your ridiculous collection of alarms?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Can you?
Yeah.
Every time
you say Siri, erase all of my alarms.
No, I don't want to do that. That's bad.
Every time I go, like it's random. I want to wake me up at 6:42. And it just stays.
Well, I never say 6:42. I always say, okay, tomorrow's mission critical. Siri, wake me up at 5:05, 5:10, and 5:15. Right. And then they all stay there. Yeah. And then I end up with hundreds. And the only way to get rid of them is to ask Siri to do the sweeping up.
So the InDesign Quark thing, though, is interesting, though, because it's a transition from a skeuomorphic design. Skeuomorphic meaning it's mimicking the old analog way of doing things.
That's where it lost me.
To a pure digital infrastructure.
I couldn't even parse it.
Yeah. And as a result, InDesign is a much more powerful tool than those versions. I mean, plus 20 years. But it was a painful process for all the people mired in the home.
No, like moving a text box and wrapping around a photo is, I don't know how to do it. Yeah. I mean, I'll figure it out at some point.
Well, if you need to. If you don't, then also that's fine.
I banged on about this before, but having a little bit of, having any background in graphic design is so useful for almost everything else later on.
How do you engender that in someone younger and go, how do you get them obsessive or... You know, particularly,
I think they probably learn how to use PowerPoint.
You know, I mean, the place where I really got into it was became a sort of an amateur font nerd. And once you're an amateur font nerd and you start to see that, like, some of the new San Francisco street signs, they just took the font and extended it. You can see the awful vector stretch of the letters.
Why did they just make the sign smaller?
It's like the Matrix. Or once you understand the rules of typography.
It doesn't take... This is the thing, is that font nerdery is not... It's not difficult to jump into that pool. And it's really... It's a beautiful pool. The science and the art of communication and letter form and kerning and letter weight and all that. It's a lovely love. I mean, I was just looking through some of my old sketchbooks because I was scanning some stuff for my book, and I found some old, like, I used to draw alphabets, right? That was like one of the things I did as a hobby. And it's such a great exercise to do. It gives you such a good foundation in communication.
Do you have a copy of Typeset in the Future? Dave Addy's book?
I might.
It just came out last...
Two
months ago.
We'll
make sure to get your copy. It was one of my favorite things last year. He does that blog.
The science fiction...
He has given me a tremendous amount of useful aid over the years.
And he just released a book...
That's awesome. I didn't know that.
That takes some of what he's done on the blog and then adds a couple movies.
Oh,
Blade
nice.
Runner's in there, 2001.
He's a good friend of Waves. Wally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wave helped connect him with the Pixar folks for Wall-E.
Lovely.
But there are discussions and interviews he does in the book about, you know, why serif fonts are, you know, why there are no serif fonts in science fiction, essentially, right? Like,
right.
When you think
He talks about that.
Yeah.
I've never thought about
why
that.
Why is it? Is because the future is brutalist?
Well, because the further, and this is like a simplification, one of the reasons, potentially, is the further you move away from the reason serif fonts were needed, why were serif fonts needed?
To make it readable at small sizes.
To make
sizes,
it readable
yeah.
on paper. In the quote-unquote future, paper is not the medium you read
right.
on. And so the further you distance yourself from the mechanics of type, then the more futuristic it looks.
Interesting.
From that perspective.
There was a really good, I can't remember the name of it, I was looking for it a second ago, but there was a great like YouTube or Vimeo short that I watched the other day about the process of typesetting for newspapers before the presses were digital, when they had to literally make lead versions of each column in the newspaper every day, and then they would melt it down at the end of the night and do another one the next day.
Oh my God.
And like, just the sheer mechanics of that kind of typesetting work, and the fact that these poor guys are handling, like, I assume it's like a lead antimony, something incredibly toxic on like three different levels, alloy, is fascinating to make
totally.
Millions of copies of newspapers a day.
Yeah.
The other one, another good place to start on font stuff, I know everybody here has seen it, but Helvetica is a good place to start if you're interested in that kind of stuff and want to learn more. The one thing I'll tell you is if you learn about kerning, it will literally haunt you because you will see problems with it everywhere. It will make you very angry.
No.
It's like Chekhov's gun, but for the real world.
It is, and you really see it. And I think it's a lovely way to see the world. You know, one of the things about graphic design, and it still holds for digital, is... In order to lay out a page, let's just say you're laying out a single page, in order so that it communicates what you want it to communicate, you go through these layers, right? You have the information and you slam it down, and then you've got the information includes words and pictures. And then there's this point at which you have to you have to kind of see if it works at a distance, and you have to interface with it as a physical body.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I always start my designs with literal pencil sketches in terms of the weights of the proportions of the page. And just that exercise made me a far better model maker when I started doing model making because, again, of that balance. And I remember my father, who was a painter, worked really hard to see different aspects of the... Of how the formal elements of his paintings work together. So he would not only look at them from a distance, he'd walk to the other side of his studio, he'd also turn them upside down.
Oh.
He'd also walk to the other side of his studio and look at a painting in a mirror to get like double the throw, mm-hmm. and to just again to see if these elements are balancing each other.
And the literal lens in which most of media is consumed today, smartphones and cameras, like. That's why whenever we do model making or sculpting projects, when we do stuff with Frank, you just every so often take a step back, take a photo with your phone.
Yeah.
Because that's how most people will see it.
Exactly.
In terms of documentaries, the abstract documentary series that Netflix did a couple of years ago.
Scott Dadich is wonderful.
Yes. There's a great episode on Paula Scher, who did as a graphic designer in New York, and that one's a awesome episode if you're into graphic design. She did the design for the Public House, the branding for Public House in New York. And so that one, highly recommend
it. Oh, that's fantastic.
Before we continue on with the conversation, I want to let you know that this week's episode of Still Entitled is also made possible by TripleByte. Applying to programming jobs sucks. You have to put the right keywords in your resume, and you spend hours and hours on phone screens and take-home projects. And that's assuming the company even responds to your application. Well, if you're a software engineer, TripleByte can help. They work with over 400 top tech companies, from big names like Dropbox and Adobe to exciting startups. You do one brief online interview with them, and if you do well, you get to go straight to the final interviews with the companies on their platform. It's like the common app for software engineers. TripleByte does not look at your resume or where you went to school. All they care about is if you can code. There are so many people I know who I went to school with who maybe don't have the best resumes or maybe even didn't finish their degrees, and they have tough times getting past recruiter screens. And a service like this can definitely help. Apply now at triplebyte.com/untitled. That's TripleByte, B-Y-T-E, byte as in 8 bits, .com/untitled. And as a special offer for listeners of this show, if you take a job through TripleByte, they'll offer you a $1,000 signing bonus. All right, back to the conversation.
I saw Vice this week. My mom was in town. Hi, Mom. She's an avid podcast
yeah,
listener.
Mom.
She was in town this weekend, and we had a ton of fun. And we went and saw, we saw two movies. Maybe we even saw three movies. We did. We went and saw
Enter
Vice.
The Spider-Verse. Please.
No, we didn't see Spider-Verse.
Oh,
I'm sorry. We went and saw Vice, which is so good. We came home and watched The Big Short.
Also
which is
very good.
Just a master. If you haven't seen Big Short since it came out,
I haven't.
I was shocked by how much better it was than I remembered. The Big Short is nothing short of a masterpiece. And I feel like Adam McKay is like someone said to him at a party.
From the man who brought you Austin Powers.
No, I feel like Adam McKay is like someone said to him at a party, you know what's unfilmable? Credit default swaps. And he said,
oh, yeah.
I'll take that bet.
Yeah.
And then someone else said, you know who's an impossible subject to make a movie out of? The monster Dick Cheney. And he said, I'll take that bet.
Is it too real? Or can you distance yourself from the reality of the events?
So I was afraid going into it. So when I saw the trailer, I turned to my wife and I was like, I'm not ready to feel any sympathy for this monster. Cheney's always been the blackest villain in my mind of that whole period. And the movie does not soften Cheney one bit. It's an incredible portrait. Christian Bale is mind-blowing in it. Did you see it?
Yeah, so I saw everything I know about Vice is contained in what I saw in the Golden Globes earlier this week, which consisted of me learning that it was about George Bush and Dick Cheney. me thinking, oh, man, wow, they really made Christian Bale look like George Bush. He looks almost like Sam Rockwell in this movie. And then me being like, wait, is Dick Cheney? Is Christian Bale Dick Cheney? Oh, wow.
Also, Amy Adams is a revelation.
She's always,
Lynn
always
Cheney.
Good.
No, I know. She's always good. She's
always
incredible
good.
In this film. It's really worth watching. And then we saw Crazy Rich Asians.
Oh. Mm.
Which I very enjoyed. I mean, I can't remember if you said this, but someone told me it's basically a Stanley Donen film. It's like watching Singing in the Rain.
And that's it, the show and dance. John M. Chu, who directed it, he directed start off with music videos, and he did like the Justin Bieber film.
Mm-hmm.
And so he that's his whole thing.
Is that Don't Stop Believin'?
I think so. He also did Step Up, one of the Step Up.
Okay, okay.
So it is the transitions all. There's so many ways in which I can see him using Stanley Donen color palettes as inspiration. And you really feel at any moment in Crazy Rich Asians that someone's about to break into song. Right?
Into song and tap dance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
But it's delightful.
And
I mean, it's light as a feather. Blow on it and it disappears. You know, the plot doesn't have right. a lot of meat on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a fun pop book.
There
right?
was
yeah. But the Mahjong scene.
The Mahjong scene is fantastic.
Yeah.
There was a really good article that I read last week about the prop design, like who, the prop master and how they actually managed to do the props for that movie. Because
what do you mean?
Well, so they didn't have the budget to actually buy and rent the jewelry and cars and furs and all the things that they did.
Right.
So a lot of the shooting was unbelievably constrained by time. So they'd have like a set of earrings for 4 hours one day.
Oh,
and
wow.
when the money for the security guy for that set of $500,000 earrings ran out, that shoot was over, and they had to do the rest of that.
If those were in two scenes. They had to shoot those two scenes back to back.
Oh yeah, and bang it out really fast. like it was. There were great. I mean, everybody knows the story about Michelle Yeoh's ring, yes. which was the green jade ring. That it was her personal ring.
Oh, I didn't realize. Yeah, she bought it
for herself after one of the movies. She buys herself a gift after each of her movies, and that was one of her.
I'll buy her a gift. Yeah. I'm afraid that Michelle Yeoh will never love me as much as I love her.
Look, that's true for many of us. But yeah, it was. It's. I'll dig up the link and send it to you, Norm. It was fascinating.
Awesome. After we recorded last week and talked about Free Solo, I did watch Meru.
Yeah.
Okay.
Amazing. Intense. Oh my god. And then,
how about the first? So it's like halfway through the movie when you first hear Jimmy Choo curse.
And Jimmy Chin.
Jimmy Chin, sorry. When you hear him curse and you realize this is him unhinged and it is just like the tiniest hair's breadth away from totally calm.
Yeah.
Like that's how measured those guys can be in the face of worst adversity.
I think the whole time we're watching, like, the question we're asking is, who's filming this? Who's filming this? And like, they're filming it.
I have a theory. I don't think that they were filming when the hutch broke. I think that they added that footage because Chin knew that they needed some footage of like, the thing broke.
Really?
I'll wager. I don't begrudge that at all. If I was him up on that mountain, I would get that shot too because you need the storytelling.
You mean they refilmed it in that moment?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Because most climbing movies are reenactments, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know...
Well, and Touching the Void is a terrific example of a reenactment that is as good as the best mountain climbing narrative you've ever seen.
And then Gunther led me to another Netflix watch, because Mirror's on Netflix, but it's about... it's called Valley Uprising. It's about the climbing culture in Yosemite the 50s to today.
Oh, wow.
And it's all the, like, who started first climbing?
Right.
And Half Dome in Yosemite. And not to spoil everything, but, like, all the big personalities. Back then, the people who wanted to be the first to climb, there was no free soloing.
Right.
They would climb up and then leave the gear up and come back down and then climb up, and because it would still count as a climb. Because the quote-unquote climb would be just putting in
the pittons and stuff,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. And so a climb up Half Dome, the first climb took 18 weeks.
Oh, my God, because they just keep incrementally adding hardware.
Yes. And they'd be drinking up there.
Why didn't they come down from the top?
Well, the accomplishment is getting up from the bottom to the top.
Why not put the route in from the top down?
Don't troll this.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to bring this for you guys.
But it was fascinating. Like, that was the accomplishment back then.
Yeah.
Well, figuring out the routes was unbelievably challenging on those. Yeah.
Amazing.
I watched, I did a double feature this weekend of the third Bourne movie, Bourne Ultimatum, I think.
That's the last one with Matt Damon?
It's the last of the first wave with Matt Damon.
Yeah, the end of the trilogy.
Yeah.
Is it Winterbottom? No, it's not Winterbottom.
It's the one with Claire Danes.
Yeah.
Well, Claire Danes is all of them, but...
No. Julia Stiles.
Julia Stiles. Yes, you're right.
Well, that's what the first Bourne film did really well, is that all the supporting characters are really good. Walton Goggins is on the team in the first Bourne film.
Is he a tech
really?
On a computer?
Yeah, he's one of the techs, I believe.
Oh, man. I didn't realize that. And then I watched... you guys had recommended Jack Reacher over and over again through the years. The first one.
Yeah.
We don't talk about the second one, apparently.
I don't know about the second one.
Yeah. But the first one...
with Rosamund Pike and Werner Herzog.
Uh-huh. And Robert Duvall! And that movie's unbelievable.
Isn't it great?
It is difficult to watch at times. It is very, very intense.
Yes.
It does... I don't want to spoil stuff, but like the opening, it's like that entire story is told in the first like 5 minutes of the movie, and like it's just up to you to get there with Tom Cruise
You're
by the end.
Up.
Yeah. So it's a slower movie than you think.
There's a point at the hour at the end of the first hour where he starts to put things together. I was like, well, that wrapped up quicker than I expected.
Way he shows up is like, who's Jack Reacher? I'm Jack Reacher. What? I mean, it gets a little silly. And to be clear, I've read all the Jack Reacher novels, and anybody out there who's read them, I don't disagree with you that Tom Cruise does not physically match. Jack Reacher's supposed to be 6'5", 6'6", and like 250 pounds, like just muscle and not you know, not super attractive, but like just like get it done.
But again,
the Jack Reacher movie with Tom Cruise is a terrific movie in and of itself.
That could have been an anybody movie. It didn't have to be a Jack Reacher movie.
Yeah.
I found it utterly charming.
The fight scene with the five guys, one of my favorite fight scenes in movies.
It's one of those ones that it does the thing that Hollywood movies do in fight scenes where there's cuts away after the hits and stuff like that. But it also doesn't look like they cheated.
No, and you feel like you understand spatially everything that's happening.
Oh, you absolutely understand what's happening. The car chase... when
he gets out of the car,
when he gets out of the car, walks over and just stands puts the hat on. The guy hands him his hat. Yeah, it's very good.
And Herzog is a wonderfully scary, awful villain.
Yeah. So I went back and watched Fallout a few weeks ago again, second time, and I wanted to see kind of this path because Chris McQuarrie is started as working with Chris Nolan, right?
Chris McQuarrie wrote script for Usual Suspects.
Oh, that's right. Okay. And I wanted to see the through line. And like, there's very much the things that came later with Mission Impossible, with Fallout and Rogue Nation, but in a more constrained way with Reacher. It was really fun.
The fights, and again, the fight choreography in Reacher, I've never looked up who the fight choreographer was, but it's some of the best fight choreography in recent movies. In terms of its clarity, there's a later fight in Reacher where he's fighting with a bunch of idiots in a house, and he doesn't do incredibly well. The close confines mean he gets hit a few times.
But they're buffoons.
They are buffoons. Like, and the close quarters fighting is... almost absurd, but feels very realistic.
And I think that, like, I love Robert Duvall. One of the all time greats.
Yeah, totally.
And this is a top tier Robert Duvall role.
And Duvall is a national treasure who is sort of like, seems to be drifting a little out of public consciousness, but he's super important.
Saving my night vision.
And like, if you've never seen The Apostle. The Apostle's a masterpiece. Another Walton Goggins, incredible Walton Goggins appearance. Duvall is one of the all-time greats. And I grew up loving Tender Mercies.
I never saw that.
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful early Duvall film with Tess Harper. I believe his daughter is played by a super young Ellen Barkin, who's like 18 at the time the movie came out. And he plays a drunken singer who kind of hits bottom and wakes up in a motel in Texas run by Tess Harper and stays. And that's about it. That's about the plot of the movie, but it's really beautiful, really important. Cool. As my dad said, it reminded him of what growing up in Texas was like. Miles and miles of nothing but miles and miles.
Any other recommendations?
That's it for me.
I think that's about it.
I would love to hear from people if they have favorite documentaries or books about type graphic design, because that's something I totally collect. And love reading.
Yeah.
So then there's all the design guides, like the New York City subway, Massimo Vignelli subway design.
The
Bicentennial. I was hanging out with a graphic designer the other day who was asking me, do you have this one? Do you have this one? Do you have this one? All those design guides and the New York City subway is maybe one of the most beautiful examples, but also the London Tube design is a masterpiece, and for different reasons with different executions, all that stuff is really great to dive into.
Like it's part of one of the things that I always love is finding out how how of the mechanics of things that you're super familiar, how things work behind the scenes in ways that you don't usually get exposed to.
And when you're moving through the subway and you're seeing your subway signs, it's shocking to realize that people actually spent months and months and months, if not years, coming up with the right line weight and kerning and spacing and background to assemble these signs so that you can read them quickly while you're moving from thing
the
to thing.
The one for highway signs for the U.S. interstate signs.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
So they did, probably 15 years ago now, they changed the font on all of the green highway signs around the country.
Yeah.
And it was really controversial because the font that was in place before was designed specifically to be readable at like 600 meters or something like that when you're going 70 miles an hour in the dark, you know, with just headlights reflecting off of it. And it was an infinitesimal font change. But yeah, you know, a huge undertaking. And like that design was all done 60, 70 years ago, 75 years ago now.
It was there's a beautiful 99% Invisible about some LA pranksters who
I was just thinking about that
who took us there was a street a highway sign that was not as clear as it should be.
I remember this
dividing between like 405
and the 10 or something
and then they recreated or the built, I guess they hijacked the sign and created clarity in the sign.
Well, they built a new version of the sign.
They built a new
right?
version of the sign to the exact specs of the original, and it stayed up for more than a decade.
And because it worked.
Because it actually.
I think they left it. It was the end of the story, right?
No, they didn't leave it.
Once it was revealed, the changes they proposed are now in effect.
Okay.
But the actual art piece of that blue
the sign was recycled
sign,
almost
was
immediately.
And they never found it.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
RIP.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it.
Yeah. So 99% Invisible, great podcast. Everybody should listen to it.
One last thing. We talked about Ghost in the Shell. There was a big auction that Prop Store did, and we got some pieces from it. They're doing more pieces from that movie in an auction, I believe, January 16th. The Thermoptic suit. There's another Thermoptic suit that's going to go up for auction.
Are you going to buy it for Danica?
No. She just had a baby. That would be. I would. It would not.
You're
going to
get in trouble, Norm. Yeah. Be careful.
There's a geisha pieces and other costumes.
I want one of those geisha masks.
It's the best thing from the movie.
That's amazing.
That's all in Prop Store.
Amazing.
Okay.
All right. Excellent.
See you all next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thanks for listening this week. And once again, I want to let you know that this episode is made possible by TripleByte. Applying to programming jobs sucks, from endless applications to countless hours of technical screens. With TripleByte, there's a better way. All you do is one online interview, and then you get to go straight to the final interviews at hundreds of companies, from tech giants like Dropbox to exciting startups. It's like the common app for software engineers with no resume needed. Apply for your next job now at triplebyte.com/untitled. And if you take a job through TripleByte, they'll offer you a $1,000 signing bonus. That's TripleByte, BYTE.com/untitled. We'll see you next week.